Perfect timing.
You're just getting started.
Okay. Good afternoon. Did you already get us in?
Nope, you're good to go.
Good. Now that's on the record, too. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Thursday, February 12th, 2015, opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. And I'd start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 5502, Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Jordan, Mr. Pack, Mr. Allen, are you coming up right away or just waiting?
Yes.
Waiting. Cool. And I would like to start by thanking Mr. Jordan, Mr. Pack, for their patience and apologizing that you ended up standing around for a while. I should have known better than to think that we could get through that policy bill in less than a full meeting. So thank you and my apologies for your wasted time. So nice to have you back with us today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having us again today, and absolutely no problem. We
Thank you.
Understand the process quite well, so that happens. Today, we're a little bit rearranging things and picking up some things that we didn't quite finish a couple of days ago. I'm going to start by finishing up Enterprise Goods and Services, which we were talking about when we were here last. And we've just got a couple of slides, and then Mr. Pack and Pat Allen are going to take you through a list of things that we told you we were going to do a couple of years ago and what the status is on all those things. So that's our agenda for today.
Certainly.
Yes.
Before you get started, I don't want to ruin the rhythm of your presentation, but I want to come back and take up something that we talked about last time and you and I talked about in my office. And that was the rather startling juxtaposition between the conversation here about services that DAS provides to small agencies and boards and commissions. And it was not more than a half an hour later that we were sitting in another subcommittee hearing how a small agency had fled DAS, given a 300% increase in the charges for HR alone. And so you know this question is coming. This isn't an ambush. Help us understand how that hopefully anomalous situation manifest itself and how many other small agencies or boards and commissions have likewise fled.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, the way we approach these internal services, and I believe I said this earlier in our presentations, we do not compel agencies to use DAS as a service provider, first of all. There are many relationships. I don't know the exact number. I know that the Land Use Board of Appeals collaborates with Ag, I believe, for some services. I know that DLCD and Ag collaborate on HR services. So those relationships occur across state government where one entity will supply some service to another one, especially when they're physically proximate to each other. That happens quite a bit. As far as the issue of DAS rates and people coming or going from DAS, the customer board for EHRS went through an extensive analysis of DAS's service catalog and the cost of those services before this biennium, and really came to the conclusion that we were highly subsidizing the rates for HR service. And those rates did go from $33 per person, I believe, to $99 per FTE. And so the story is accurate. That's what happened with the rates. The customer board felt that those rates were being highly subsidized and believed that they should go to real cost. And of course, the real estate agency made a decision that they thought they could get those services somewhere else. Now that begets other questions. And I heard secondhand heard some of those questions from the other committee. And I guess the way I'd like to explain some of this is that I can certainly see Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife seeing an agency that has quite small FTE saying, we can take on that workload, and it's a marginal workload for us, and there will be no new cost to their agency because they'll hire no new staff. They'll incorporate it into their workload because it's a marginal amount. At some point, those workloads get to a place where you've got to bring on more staff. And so the way this cost structure usually works is a stair step kind of structure. And so you see those intermittent relationships between agencies where a large agency can take a small agency's workload and it's a marginal amount and they will charge them some kind of reasonable amount, but it's no extra cost to the agency. So those are the kinds of dynamics that happen across the agencies, and we don't, as a policy, restrict those kinds of relationships, interagency relationships, for internal service delivery. I hope that helps explain kind of what goes on.
It does, but I guess the problem I'm getting back to is system improvements. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be the most equal among, or the more equal among equals, right. And if you are not modeling the good behavior of a price sheet that is dependable, and you've got other little agencies and boards fleeing someplace else, how does that set a leadership standard in terms of the back rooms? I've been mystified by why we have all this multiplicity of back rooms to begin with. I mean, I guess I can get it that ODOT would need their own HR. It's big enough. But it seems sort of like a box of mice somebody tipped over. You got these little agencies out just hunting for the best deal. I would think that the mothership would be the best deal. And so I'm looking for where's the failure in the system here?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I don't know that I would characterize what is happening today as a failure. I think there are multiple ways to get this work done. One might argue that what we have is a quasi-market-driven system where people can look for the best deal, and they go find it. And that deal, quite often, is a value proposition for the agency, cost and service. And so it's not just cost that they go search for sometimes. Having said that, I think you bring up an excellent point about, let me put it in economic terms, the efficiency of this market. Unfettered, this market occurs, but it's not very efficient. And so I think there is a role for DAS to provide more structure, even if we stay with where people can make choices, that we need to provide more structure. And I will add one other point, and then I'll be done. And that is, as I've mentioned before, we're a little bit immature yet in this notion of customer boards. They're kind of working their way. And so when you mention price stability, there have been some historic things that have gone on in our agency and others where we've subsidized rates and did different things to try and help people, I think with good motivation. But ultimately, that can come back to bite you. And I think what the customer board did was they did the analysis of the service catalog and said, we can't be subsidizing these things anymore. We've got to move to market price, I guess, a cost model. So that's where we have been on this.
One other thing, Madam Chair, if you'll indulge me. I think that there is an optic that is pernicious here. And that optic is, in the context of the other committee, when the fact that the real estate agency was seeking services from ODF&W, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is out seeking a fee increase because they can't sustain their own operations. And without necessarily understanding that this is fee for service, there was a temptation to come to the conclusion they're doing other people's work and they're asking hunters and fishers to subsidize that work. I think that it's poorly understood, and I think it raises legitimate questions in a price-sensitive macro environment where you're asking hunters and fishers to subsidize realtors' back room.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I think you make a great point about the optics. And back to my earlier point, I think it can get confusing for people when you have multiple revenue sources to an agency and they're providing service to another agency that has other multiple revenue sources. And while I can pretty much guarantee you that in the accounting systems, we work all those things out, A87 issues and other things like that. But the optics of it can be confusing. There's no question about it. I agree.
I'm done, Madam Chair. The horse is no longer standing, so.
I resemble that remark.
Oh, I think we all need a little laughter today. All right. Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Mr. Jordan, a little different line of questioning. I've been puttering around in budgets like I sometimes do. My staff thinks it's an incurable disease. But
and I'm grateful for it, actually, Senator. It's one of the things I count on you for.
Thank you. The Department of Forestry budget shows about a 35% increase in government service charges. And so we're looking a little bit further. When you go to your price list, it actually only shows about a $4,500 increase instead of an $8,600 increase. Anyway, to get to the chase, it appears that there is a significantly increased service charge for data center. And I don't know if this is the time to discuss that or not, but but I think we should have an in-depth discussion of what's going on there. Is that a failure in the past to amortize the depreciation, or what is it?
Very briefly, because we will talk about this in a couple of days, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt. One of the big cost drivers, and there are more than just one, but the biggest one, as you mentioned, is the issue of the infrastructure replacement for network that we came to you back in February and talked about. That infrastructure replacement, to be very brief, the infrastructure in the initial setup of the data center was paid for through debt. It was, and we went over this previously, it was a five-year debt service structure, paid off in 5 years. The idea was that there would be something that would happen to change the way we did business so that we would be able to replace that. Well, we were 8 years into a five-year plan last year, and the infrastructure was falling down around us. What had happened through the recessionary years is no one wanted to impose the extra cost on agencies to make that change, and we just got to a place where we had to. The system was falling apart. So what we came in and asked you for was about $47 million, I believe, over three biennia. We started this biennia to expend those funds, but we are also shifting from a pay-as-you-use structure to a pay-as-you-go structure. So we are not only paying off the debt to rebuild this infrastructure up front, we are also charging agencies to build a sinking fund to replace it the next time it needs to be replaced. So we're kind of double paying right now. That's the biggest driver at ETS. On rates.
Follow up then. Then the total cost, biennial total cost of this is around $47 million.
It's closer to 40, according to Barry.
And that is being allocated to all the different agencies.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Is it being allocated equally? Because the Department of Forestry is a pretty small agency.
No, we can go over the price list and the assessment.
Probably,
when we get to ETS,
better time,
we shifted philosophy there, and that's
more,
part of the shift. Yes.
The question is more of a
winners
heads up. We want to talk about it.
Okay.
Mr. Siebert, do you want to add?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I believe this biennium was about $18 million is built in for the for the depreciation. And I would also note that if you're seeing large swings in the ETS charges, the most likely result of that is what was mentioned earlier, is the switch to do if I remember correctly, about 60% of the ETS budget as an assessment based on FTE and budget size.
That was my point. It seems like it's awfully large for a very small agency.
And you'll see that. You'll see again, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, you'll see that in some of the agencies, some pretty large swings. I've seen some in some of the budgets I've done, ODF&W, for example, and some of the others. Some big jumps. OWEB is the largest one I can think of because they have a really big grant budget and a few people, but they have a really big budget. And so when you do an assessment based on budget size, you know, their assessment went up, I think, 200% around that.
Thank you.
So with that, if there are no – oh, excuse me. There is a question. Madam Chair.
Sorry, Representative Taylor.
Thank you.
I'm multitasking
just
too much today.
Oh, excuse me. Building on something that Senator Johnson said, and I just wanted, I don't have the price sheet in front of me. I've had to use that in the past. However, I assume that there is obviously a manual that you hand out when you have different agencies use the price sheet. Is that correct?
I don't know that there's a manual, but the price sheet does go out to all the agencies.
So there probably is one, I would assume, which is fine. But in there, is there a criteria for things that folks are allowed to opt out from? And does it explain the impact that will happen if you choose to do your own purchasing on something versus choosing to do your own? You see what I'm saying? Yes. Because I think that what's happening sometimes in my experience is that folks opt out from using some of the services that DAS offers because they see that they can do one aspect of it more cheaply, and then they do contract you with certain things and not with another. And I think that I'd like to hear, and hopefully you'll say yes, we are training them to understand the long-term impact of when they choose to opt out of a DAS service versus stay in. And that is why I think the inefficiencies can occur, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do certain administrative activities and not do another. And I just want to make certain that our employees are well-trained and well-informed of the decisions that they're making and what the long-term costs are for doing those, because they set up whole new systems and et cetera. So I was just wondering if you could talk about that, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, you covered a lot of ground there. So,
sorry. But I know you're a smart man.
Pick which parts are really relevant, and I guess I'll choose to answer your question this way. First of all, one of the reasons that the ETS price list changed and the assessment component was there, Mr. Psyche tried to explain that a bit when he was here, is that there are certain fixed costs, and we allocated those fixed costs mostly around budget and FTE across the users. And those costs are really not escapable. We're assessing them. We tried to be thoughtful about which services that agencies could pick and choose from, and it wouldn't be detrimental to the overall health of the whole group. There's a second and deeper question, I think, in your comments regarding kind of advice and or regulation around long-term impacts, yes, of those agency choices. Mm-hmm. I would say, generally speaking, we are yet to mature to that level of discussion with agencies, but okay, it's coming. HR is the classic. Not only do they not choose our service sometimes, they don't choose any service sometimes, mm-hmm, which, of course, the whole of state government runs a risk when people aren't getting good HR advice and making HR decisions sometimes. So I think that's a next level for us to get to.
No, follow up. So when you say, thank you, Senator Hayward, so when you say you think that's a good idea, is there some, this has been obviously going on for a while, and I know you're very forward thinking, and I appreciate all the work that you and Mr. Pack have done. Is there a way to kind of include that, or is it just too much to take, mm-hmm, on right now?
I don't know, Barry.
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, if I may, for the record, Barry Pack, Department of Administrative Services. I think some of the situation is based on the structure of the law that either requires service through DAS or allows exceptions or allows full delegation. So there are multiple ways in which an agency can make a choice to go on their own. Mm-hmm. In the technology world, agencies come to us with an exception from requirements to use our services. And in that vein, we do sit down with the agencies and try and go through the cost and service comparisons. And one of the issues is trying to make sure we're comparing apples to apples. And how do you determine the full cost of a server? What components do you put into that?
Mm-hmm.
Security versus network versus, on a raised floor versus in an unsecure data center standard, mm-hmm, location. So we try to work through those issues and come to an agreement upon the cost to cost so that agencies are aware. But there are also plenty of times in which an agency has delegated authority to do their own purchasing, for example. And so we do it where we can. I think, as Mr. Jordan said, it's imperfect at best.
If I may, I know Co-Chair Smith has a question, but Mr. Siebert just reminded me of a very important point. In the last biennium, we made a decision to allow the university system to opt out. And that's thousands and thousands of employees that are now out of the system, and those costs that are fixed and that have to be spread out over every state employee, we suddenly have a dramatically smaller number of state employees. This happened, I believe, when OHSU went out on its own as a public corporation. Now we see it happening with our university system. There were good reasons for doing that. Some people agreed, some people disagreed. We did it. And now one of the things we're seeing is the fallout of that, because you have to cost shift all of those fixed costs onto a smaller number of employees. So I appreciate, Mr. Siebert, that reminder. It's a really important point. Was there anything else that we should have been thinking about? Co-Chair Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
One of these days, we will allow you to get off your first slide.
It's okay. These days, I like being here.
So do we, actually.
I want to go back to questions I asked a few days earlier. I'm trying to get my arms around this fee structure. Is it possible for our committee to get a sample of the price sheets you were referring to? I want to see an actual price sheet.
Mr. Chair, if I may, we are working on a response to that original batch of questions around our assessments and our fees. I have a draft on my desk this morning. I pledge to get it to you by the end of the week. And Mr. Siebert and I have been talking about that is tomorrow. Yes, I know.
We all think it's almost like the end of next week at this point.
But we're working with Mr. Siebert on some time next week to actually go through that as a group. So
let me clarify a little bit of what I'm looking for. On those price sheets, is it a one size fits all price sheet, or does each agency get a price sheet based upon their size and their circumstance?
Mr. Chair, there is a single price list. It includes all of DAS services.
Is that the correct terminology? It's a price list.
It's the statewide price list.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear. Okay.
It includes DAS charges. It includes things like the State Library, Secretary of State Archives, and Audit Division charges, all those sorts of general communal enterprise charges. The bulk of it is DAS.
Okay.
Each of the DAS service divisions and or programs has a price list for all state agencies associated.
And we'll
with
be
it.
Able to get a copy of that.
And we are going to send you the full electronic copy so that you can see it. It's on our website now, but it will come.
Perfect. Okay, follow up. I've got a second question. I want to go back to the discussion we're having about an agency choosing not to participate with DAS. I need greater clarification why that is, why we allow it. If some little agency, and I'm not going to make one up, but chose not to participate on a human resource issue, why do we allow that? They don't have the expertise. They may pretend they do, but they may not. Why do we allow that to occur?
Mr. Chairman, it's and members of the committee, it's a question that's before the customer boards right now. The issue really is risk. That you're running when you don't have that threshold. Now, mind you, when an agency doesn't get service from us, they are still subject to Chapter 240 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, which set out a lot of our...
Push pause because I want to understand this. No. They choose not to get service because they want to save the money? They don't think they need the service?
Usually that's the case, or they may have an executive director for a board or commission that has HR experience and says, I don't need your service, I can do this myself.
Let me ask one more question.
Sure.
So
it's a lot.
Little agency says, don't need the help, I'm going to opt out. Tomorrow they go, oh crud, I need the help. Now they have the opportunity to opt back in.
Well, they can actually call us for specific service, a one-off service, and we can quote them a price for instance, an employee investigation. We will do that for them if they call us. They also have legal support from DOJ that they can call at a fairly sizable hourly rate. To get support on labor and employment issues also.
I'm going to ask one more question, then I'll stick right here. So when you're in the minority, our job is to look for those little areas of efficiency. I mean, that's our job here. Is there a reason why we allow some of these little agencies to have one-off employees that have that expertise when DAS may have that experience already? Would it perhaps not be an efficiency for them to not have that employee but to utilize your service?
Mr. Chair, we as an organization have historically not, when we have had the ability to not do it, we've not told agencies what they have to do. And some of this, we're having conversations right now of minimum levels of service. The customer boards are in lots of different disciplines struggling with the notion of how would you define minimum level of service, and how would an agency, if they chose not to get their service from DAS, show that they are providing a minimum level
of service. So the Cub knows this is a conversation worth having, and you folks are having that.
They are.
Ongoing.
But it's not an easy conversation, setting that minimum level.
Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yeah. Senator Johnson.
What I don't want, following the chair's example, is for the little agency to go, oh, God, I wish I could come back, after they have incurred a major judgment. And if some of the legislation that's being proposed in this building passes, it's going to make it easier for these large class action lawsuits. My big concern is managing the risk, because that's not just a risk to the little agency, that's a risk to the taxpayers of Oregon.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I couldn't agree more.
That actually says local government, not government agencies.
Huh. So Senator Whitsitt brought to our attention, I guess we need to have a little bit of understanding about this interagency stuff that's not between you and DAS. And I thank Senator Whitsitt for bringing this to our attention, and I appreciate any thoughts you have about this. But I need to understand this as well. ORS 190.010 talks about the authority of local governments to make intergovernmental agreements, and it talks about a unit of local government may enter into a written. And that's, we understand that. That's pretty clear. Counties, cities that need to, and they can make agreements with other local governments. That doesn't talk about the agreements with the state. Under what authority do state agencies make agreements with other state agencies to provide services that are common? I can understand if there's a specialized area of expertise, as you were alluding to, Mr. Jordan, but for most of the other things, how does that, under what authority does that come about?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of the actual citing,
okay.
But I do know that it is common practice for agencies to have interagency agreements to either share personnel or services or you know, it's basically a contract for things. And we do a lot of those.
And we've had a lot of those conversations in this committee. Mm-hmm. We've talked about, you know, the fact that we have a lot of these very small licensing boards, for example, and would it make more sense for them to share some of the back office functions because their licensing cycles come at different times of the year or whatever. And that makes a lot of sense, but that's, I don't know. That's more about sharing personnel than sharing core services. I think we need to keep moving at this point, unless there's anything critically new to bring up. But I do think this is something we should be thinking about a little bit. And I want to thank Senator Whitsitt again for bringing this question to our attention.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would welcome having a longer, deeper conversation with you about this whole, it's a very broad area of interaction between agencies. And so at some time, perhaps co-chairs, we could talk about how to have an interaction regarding
having
that with
one
the
of
committee.
Our meetings be about that, if we could.
Be happy
Thank
to.
You. Okay, let's let you get back to your slides.
So
now that we're half an hour into our meeting.
So back to risk management, one of the divisions in Enterprise Goods and Services is the Risk Management Division, and you can see a set of statistics. The first one regarding tort claims and the number that are closed prior to litigation, I wanted to give you a sense of the base of that. The Risk Management Group handles just south of 2,400 tort and restoration claims per year, and they have 9 adjusters that do that. So it's a fairly high volume. Wanted you to know that in employment claims, over the last 10 years, 74% of all employment claims get no payment whatsoever. So they're rejected either at some level of the process. So of that other 26% that do get some level of payment, it really happens at 3 stages through the process. So we may pay a tort claim before a lawsuit is even filed. So sometimes we'll get a notice and we'll do an investigation and we'll find, you know, there's really a problem here, and we'll negotiate a payment on that. After a lawsuit is filed, we pay about 16% are paid in that phase before trial, but after a lawsuit has been filed. And then lastly, a very small percentage actually go to trial. And of that, less than 1% of all our claims is when that payment is made. The most important part of this slide, I believe, for your benefit, is the DOJ cost part of the slide, and particularly the bottom three lines. We've talked a little bit about the drivers here, but because of those drivers, what we are seeing, 18.9% increase in the average DOJ attorney hours per litigated case.
Co-chair. Can you just share that one more time?
Sure. Mr. Chair, it's on the slide. 18.9% increase in the average number of hours DOJ spends when we litigate a case. 11.2% increase in DOJ's hourly rate. Now that's back to 2011. So remember, that's not a one-year increase. That's over a number of years. And a almost 25% increase in the average cost per litigated claim from DOJ. Now, we talked about the drivers. The limits on tort claims have gone up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Really incentivizing plaintiff counsel to continue into a litigation much further because there's a much higher chance of payoff or a chance of a higher payoff than there used to be, which of course requires DOJ to engage in that litigation to a longer state before we either settle or we actually get a judgment. So that's the main driver of we think anyway, of why these costs seem to be escalating. And there was a question.
Representative Kahn.
Thank you. Mr. Jordan, there's 198 school districts in this state. And I was wondering if school districts, not necessarily school districts, but school boards have access or know that you have these services, because it's a huge cost for a district to almost all of them these days have their own attorney, and that's a big cost in their budget. And so I was just wondering if you had any background on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Comp, I don't have a lot of background. I understand the situation you're describing, and I know it to be true. Our risk fund is for state agencies, and so it insures state agencies. The Department of Justice supplies the legal help for us.
Right.
I'm not aware of the Department of Justice having any relationship with school districts to supply legal help to them.
I might suggest that to the deputy superintendent. You know. Thank
Could
you. I appreciate your feedback.
Pleasure. I think the last thing I'd like to say, we touched on this a little earlier on this slide, or a little earlier in our talks with you, regarding the fact that this fund is actuarially analyzed. I said biennially. Someone in staff corrected me. We do it every year. So it is actuarially assessed every year. The current assessment as of June 30, 2014, the actuarial liability was $166 million. Remember, that is for claims that have already been claimed, and their anticipation of unclaimed liability that's out there that they expect in the next year. The current balance of the fund is $138.6 million. So we are currently technically underfunded under the actuarial liability. I will tell you, however, $138.6 million is as big as that fund has been since I've been here. So you have to kind of make judgments about how much money you actually need in that fund. So that's the last thing I wanted to say about this slide. And then these are the packages. I'm not going to go over each one. You have material on all of those. There is one, though, I wanted to note, and that's package 131. We've had discussions about this, and we just discussed the cost drivers regarding Department of Justice costs to us. We have not a lot of control over those costs. So the committee is aware, the payouts we make out of the fund for a claim are not limited. So there's no limitation on those payments in the budget. However, our costs to the Department of Justice are limited, and we occasionally have to come back and talk about limitation. The proposal in Package 131 is to make both DOJ costs and the payouts non-limited. So I wanted to make sure you understood. That's probably the one that's the kind of the quirkiest one. So I wanted to make sure you knew that. And with that, I'm done with this, and we may want to move along.
Yeah, let's.
Okay. I'll, if with your permission, Madam Chair, I'm going to let Pat Allen.
Thank you, Bevy. I don't mean to sound flippant, Mr. Jordan.
Understand.
I apologize.
I understand.
While Mr. Allen's coming up, as Mr. Jordan said, we were we reported to you 2 years ago on a series of projects that we were going to undertake to make some of our work a little more efficient, and we'll run through all of these. I'm going to let Mr. Allen do most of the talking, who's chair of the Improving Government Steering Committee, which is the governance body that oversees these projects, and I'll just simply drive and fill in where necessary.
Thanks, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and for fun in my spare time, I chair the Improving Government Steering Team, which is made up of a number of agency directors and deputies or business services managers whose mission is to oversee a set of projects and efforts and thinking about how state government does its business operations to make it more business-like, more cost-effective, and more effective at delivering services. As Mr. Jordan said earlier, what we're reporting on today are a number of projects that you were told about a couple of years ago as this process was getting underway. There are 9 projects here. I don't plan to go into painful detail on each of the 9 of them, but I will at least touch briefly on them. But there are a couple I'm going to dive into in some more detail because I think they're broadly illustrative of the kinds of things that we deal with. And the first, on its face, and actually beneath its face, is an incredibly boring project called Active Directory. Active Directory is basically a project when you go into a networked computer and you log on, you're logging on to a directory. And Active Directory is a reference to basically a set of standard Microsoft network products that talks about once you've gotten there, who are you, what do you have access to, what drives do you connect to, all those sorts of things that talk about how do you use the computer system. And historically, those have been done very much on an agency-by-agency siloed basis. And in the main, that works pretty well as long as all you need to do is do business within your silo. Increasingly, across the enterprise, we're trying to do projects and work that cross those agency silos in terms of individual projects or large-scale agency work or those sorts of things. And thus, at that point, those siloed network connections actually become a meaningful barrier to trying to get business done. This is a project that is really a fairly low-cost project. It's not going out and building IT or anything like that. It's really rearranging the licenses and the configuration of the licenses that we already have in state government to deliver this directory function. It was about an 11-month project, and it's one of these things that typically over time hasn't gotten done because it's not a sexy project. It's not one where you're out trying to acquire new hardware and software, but you're building this fundamental building block that becomes necessary to do a whole bunch of other projects, including some that I'm going to talk about here as we follow. So low cost, low risk, at the individual point that you're doing the project, seemingly low impact, but with a huge multiplier going forward in time. Let's go ahead and take a look at the next one. Data storage consolidation. This is there are a couple of elements to this project. This basically had to do with the technology and the location of where our backup data is. This was moving us from tape backup systems, which is very old technology for data recovery, and moving us to, you were all collectively talking about shared services earlier. This is shared services actually with another state using Montana's data storage facilities as our backup data storage facilities. One of the in addition to cost and operational benefits, of course, one of the biggest benefits to using Montana is it's well clear of any sort of geological risks and the kinds of things that could cause catastrophic failure of our own systems. Not having our backups in areas that are subject to those same systems is a prudent business practice. Let's move on to the next one. Enterprise email. This is one that I want to spend just a minute on because it really does take advantage of this Active Directory kind of a project. Ever since I've been in state government, going back 20 years, one of the constant laments that I've heard, particularly from this body, is why on earth do we have 54 different email systems across state government? Now, 20 years ago, that actually presented some huge, meaningful problems that, as email technology has evolved, have gotten to be not quite as critical. But nevertheless, 2 years ago, we're out there submitting or supporting 4 dozen plus email systems across 90 agencies and however many boards and commissions. Active Directory is actually one of those fundamental building block investments that we were able to make to begin doing a project to start consolidating those email systems. And so actually with my own agency in January coming on board, we've now consolidated 10 of those 53 email systems into a single state enterprise email system with about 9,000 users. We've also taken advantage of the opportunity to update our email domains to something that's a little more logical to our customers. So now if you are dealing with the agencies in that system, the email address, you're using our Oregon.gov emails rather than state.or.us, which doesn't trip off the tongue exactly. But the most important thing is there's one email system being administered in one place rather than that administration work being replicated across multiple agencies.
So what do you think the useful life of this will be?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Smith.
I know you're not an expert, neither.
Yeah,
what do we anticipate?
What we're doing is consolidating onto a Microsoft Outlook product that's a pretty much an industry standard product
I stand corrected. I didn't realize this was a Microsoft.
Yes. Yeah, this is not something that we have gone out and built or custom done or anything like that.
Didn't mean to interrupt you.
Let's see if there was anything else I wanted to say about.
Do you want to talk about Hackett?
Oh, yeah. So talking about consolidating from 10 systems to one, 2 years ago, you heard a great deal about the Hackett Group data that we commissioned to look at our business operations and identify places where we were operating at or below industry or world-class norms. And this notion of supporting multiple systems and the sunk cost that goes into maintaining those systems that could be used in other areas was a big piece of their message. And this is a clear example of the kind of an effort that we make to try to harvest that savings and that improvement by consolidating these systems. Now, the logical question you kind of get to is, well, we've gone from 54 to 44. 44 still sounds like a lot. Are we going to try to get to one single email system across all those enterprises? You end up with a transactional cost that goes with each of these. These aren't huge lifts, but they're not insignificant lifts to consolidate each email system. I would expect over time that we will continue to consolidate and have fewer email systems. At some point, we'll get to the place where the lift isn't worth the next one. I don't think that'll be at one email system. I can't tell you is that 30 email systems or 10 email systems or 5, but we'll get to a place where we'll have to balance what's the work that's going to have to happen to get that last system consolidated versus what you'll get for it. And at that point, we'll sort of be at the end of where this kind of an effort makes sense.
Senator Whitsitt.
How do you tabulate? How do you calculate the savings? I mean, the purpose, I assume, to going bigger, faster, safer. The purpose is to save money in NFT and so forth. And I'd like to see some metrics on what's that producing. And another thing I was looking at is, you know, the ON program. If you look at that, and I know you probably may not have been involved in it, but it was supposed to be cheaper, faster, better, safer, and the assessments have since 2010 have doubled, roughly, and the cost has roughly doubled, so it must be a lot safer.
Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt, in trying to calculate that, there are two components. One is fairly straightforward, and one is quite a bit less so. The straightforward component is once you've delivered an enterprise technology solution, whether it's email or anything else, you can take the cost of the hardware and the software and the licenses and the people and divide that up by the number of users and get to a dollar amount. And in this case, this consolidated system is more or less equal in cost calculated that way to individually operated systems, although it varies quite a bit from agency to agency. The issue that's harder to get to but is very meaningful is the organizational cost in focus and use of resources to maintain its own independent system as opposed to having that system maintained and operated by somebody else. So if I have technology professionals in my organization who have to spend time keeping the email system running, that means they can't spend time keeping the systems that I use for bank examinations running. Bank examination systems, I'm the only one who uses them, and I need people who are able to focus on that kind of work. If I can have somebody else do that work on maintaining my email system, that's a value to me, but it's not one that tallies up in a price sheet or a budget as easily, but it's an organizational focus issue. Does that help?
Yes. Complete aside, but when I put computers in my veterinary clinic years and years ago, We went from taking two people 2 days to bill monthly to one person about 4 hours. Mm-hmm. Didn't show up in the cost of the computing, but it certainly showed up in the bottom line.
That's, right, yeah, right, exactly.
See.
And to some extent, I think this goes with the issue that we were speaking about at the beginning of the meeting. You know, having standardization of services and practices across state government means that we have more opportunity to share employees as needed,
yes,
for people to transfer to opportunities in other departments for growth experiences. We don't have to worry about interoperability of systems in the same way.
Yes, and I'll come back to that very issue in another project that we'll talk about here in a moment. Let's go ahead and go on to the next
Thank
one.
You.
Electronic pay stubs is an interesting little project that illustrates scope control, I would say. This is a project that is not really any fancier than taking printed pay stubs that every employee in state government received and turning it into a system where they log on to a portal and are able to get an electronic version of their pay stub. If they need to print the pay stub for some reason, they can print the pay stub. Unlike a paper pay stub that they have to put in a folder somewhere, they're able to go back and see 13 months worth of history of their pay stubs if they've got questions about changes over time. The interesting thing about delivering this project, two factors. One was, as this project was unfolding, it was really easy for people to kind of pop up their hands and say, yeah, wouldn't it be really cool if this thing also did this, whatever this is. And part of the success of this project was, frankly, a maniacal determination to say no, that you don't get that cool thing. You get what we're going to do, which is an electronic pay stub. And once we've got an electronic pay stub delivered, we can talk about other things that we might have this thing do. But that focus and that willingness to say, no, you're not going to get that extra bell or whistle is really a critical component to, I believe, delivering successful IT projects. The other thing is that, and I'm sorry, Senator Johnson's not in the room, she frequently asks me to let her know what are the things that the legislature can do to help us be able to deliver things more effectively. And believe it or not, you actually needed to make a change in state statute for us to be able to deliver electronic pay stubs. I don't remember the exact provision, but there was a piece of doing this that was actually illegal, and we needed you in one of the short sessions, I believe, to actually pass a bill to allow us to deliver this.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. Just to give you a breather from talking for a moment, a few years ago when I chaired what was called a government efficiency task force, way in my earlier, probably first session I started talking about this topic, I convened a group of local and state government people to talk about how state government it might be it in the way of local government with requirements and so forth. One of the statutes that we recognized needed to be changed, and we did, was we were requiring certain notices to be paper notices to be posted on a bulletin board in a public library once a week. People weren't flocking to the public library to look to see if there was a new paper notice on the bulletin board, but by allowing it to be put on the web instead, anybody could look at it any time of day, whenever they wanted. It really greatly increased public access and visibility for whatever this notice was. So I just wanted to let the committee know I've been looking for opportunities also. I'm very appreciative that you are finding those things, and I want to keep in mind that sometimes we need to make sure that we're keeping our requirements of local governments who need to work with us and contract with us. We need to do this sometimes together with local government.
Absolutely. Let's,
if I may, before we move on, just one other point that I'd like to make, Representative Nathanson. On the outcomes, one of the things you'll see that looks rather obvious is self-service password resets. But I bring it up because it's one of the facts that came out of the Hackett study, which was the amount of time our IT people were spending resetting people's passwords when it's an obviously simple thing that happens in any other website that you have a log into. If you forget your password, you click a button that says forget password, and you get one emailed to you. We've built that into these systems now so that we're learning.
I have to say I'm just surprised it's only $140,000. I mean, given how many state employees we have delivering papers, pay stubs to each of us every 2 weeks or every month,
Well, so the interesting piece there is that this doesn't really touch the underlying financial systems, which are what generate the data. Mm-hmm. Really, it was that last piece of turning that data, sending that data to a printer and having it print a document versus sending it to a portal and having it populate a set of screens. So they're really the technology required here is incredibly simple. As long as you maintain that scope focus and don't start building on a whole bunch of additional features.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'm just saying that, you know, if you think about how much paper that is and how many people we've got and how much postage is, if you can't deliver it by courier and even
pretty good return.
Bulk rates, I would think it'd be more than $140,000. But that's okay.
Let's go ahead and go into the next one. This is online timekeeping. I just want to use this as an excuse to show you a couple of pictures in just a second. This actually takes advantage of the same portal that we use for the pay stubs, where employees can go on and deal with their time. Now, the question that you might ask is, well, what kind of a system do you use to record time? Let's go to the next slide. And many of our agencies use this kind of a system where you go in and you can see this is obviously quite intuitive to employees for how they might fill it out. In my agency, I would describe the system as dead trees and ink, because it looks like that for filling out a timesheet. You can imagine that when an employee has gone through that process and that then needs to be manually keyed into an automated system, the opportunities for errors by the employee, errors by the manager who's certifying the payroll, errors by the person who's putting it in are huge. We've replaced both those systems with... It's not terribly clear, but basically it's sort of a graphical user interface, intuitive. It's a calendar that shows the number of hours in the day. It's pre-populated with things like how much vacation time do you have available, so you can't make a common error of claiming vacation time you wouldn't be entitled to until the next month. It makes sure that the number of hours worked equal the number of hours that are there in the month. And these are the kinds of very innocent errors that in people in an entirely manual system often make, and that there's a huge amount of rework that goes into. And so we're moving forward with implementing this system across a variety of agencies.
I don't know how, to those of you who were on the committee last year may remember during this session, these days, in 2013, Ms. Miller, Mr. Pack's predecessor, talking about this very issue and talking about spending 90 minutes a week. Am I exaggerating, Mr. Jordan? 90 minutes a week doing her own time card. And she's a salaried employee. She's not even an hourly employee. Do you remember that? We talked about that at some length. It was really remarkable. So it's really great to see that people don't spend ludicrous amounts of time doing this anymore.
Madam Chair,
go ahead, and then...
I was just going to say, as supervisors, at the end of each pay period, we have to go through and lock our employees' times, which means we confirm that what they've recorded is what we believe that they've actually took. And as a supervisor on the green screen, it took me to pull out my manual and flip through and remind myself exactly how it took me forever. I can lock an employee, all of my employees' time, in a matter of about 5-10 minutes. Much easier.
Great. Co-Chair Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So as folks are putting together this online payroll system, who's ensuring that it's being done accurately? Who's the double check on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the DAS manages the state payroll system, and so we have a whole system of employees the state who work within the state payroll system. And if I can, I'm going to go back up a couple of slides. You'll see the timeline on this, 24 months. The reason for the long period of time when it's a relatively simple technology is having the resources available to test to make sure that what's happening is accurate. We were trying to line up the project timeline with the end of a collective bargaining agreement. Our payroll staff are reprogramming the payroll system to accommodate any of the negotiated changes. Then you get into the W-2 season, and then you get into, sure, you know, any other sort of payroll things. And so we were always having to juggle the testing time with the project time, which delayed the project longer than we might like. And then we wanted to do a very soft rollout. We rolled it out within just the state payroll staff first to make sure that they actually got paid what they entered, and they did. And then we rolled it out to a broader set of DAS divisions and then out and out, each time double checking to make sure that the system was actually recording and accurately paying employees.
So let me re-ask my question. So it is it an employee's direct supervisor that's responsible to go in and look at their electronic time card
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Do they have a little I concur button?
Yes, so Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on this screen.
Uh-huh. If you hit Control Plus on your keyboard, it'll make it bigger if people want to see it, or you can look it on your keyboard.
Plus.
Usually, maybe not.
Okay,
never mind.
Never mind.
Doesn't matter. Usually it works.
As a supervisor, I would log into my login. Uh-huh. I would have entered my time. There's a place where I click, and all of my employees that I supervise, their monthly timesheet comes up. I look it through. I look through my calendar to make sure it matches.
Yep.
I click confirm.
Perfect.
Moves
Thank
me to
you.
The next one.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Let's go ahead and move on to that one. Next project is a set of procurement improvement projects, and this is actually a dense cluster of projects around how to make the procurement process more effective. And I really consciously use the phrase more effective as opposed to faster or more efficient or those sorts of things, because I think certainly we're mindful of the fact that there's a set of checks and balances in procurement, and being able to go out and buy something fast is not the only value we're trying to manage procurements for. We're trying to make sure we buy things accurately and legally and paying attention to the different factors we need to consider. Two things I want to draw your attention to. Actually, one thing I want to draw your attention to, in addition to this being a cluster of projects, an example of that is the use of and development of templates with the Department of Justice for common contracting documents like requests for proposal. Right now, I'm not exaggerating. I think when I suggest that right now these documents are artisanal in nature, each agency sits down and frequently comes up with a one-off or a handful off set of documents. Department of Justice then gets this artisanally crafted acquisition document and gives it the artisanal review which it's due to make sure that it's legally sufficient. What we are working on now is a set of templates that are at a minimum a starting place. Ideally, these templates, as they're approved, and we've had a number of approved now, as they're approved, they become a document that if you use the template and you populate it correctly and you submit it, it's pretty well good to go. But if there are changes, then you've started from the same place that somebody in another agency doing a similar function has started from, and the attorney at Department of Justice knows what they're looking at, has seen it before, knows what's already been reviewed, and is able to focus on those things that are peculiar to the transaction or to the agency.
You know, Mr. Allen, it's very funny you talk about this. Say, Representative Nathanson and I were talking just the other day, and she was saying, why do we not have standard templates for these contracts? And now you're telling us, in fact, we do now have standard templates for these contracts. Was I misremembering your conversation, Representative? I apologize.
There's a lot more to it.
Yes, well, there is. But I mean, this is a starting point to show it can be done, and that we have a model. So thank you for starting with that part of it.
And that's right, reading between the lines perhaps on what Representative Nathanson didn't say. It's easy to say, let's go do templates. Doing that work is actually quite complicated and time-consuming. And there, for all of these things, there are reasons that we don't do business the ways that we're trying to do here. And you've actually got to understand those reasons and work to overcome whatever the underlying factors are. And templates is certainly one of those. Let's go on and move to the next one. They'll hear more about this separately?
On Monday on IT Day.
So this is the Human Resource Information System business case. And I just want to touch on this for a couple of reasons, because it has to do with the complexity of what a project like this is. We've talked about online time and online pay stubs. Those projects fundamentally aren't really technology projects around time and pay. Those are appliances to make existing cumbersome and old technology systems work more effectively for employees and managers to use. This is the business case to replace systems like that, the systems we use to manage positions and position authority and those kinds of issues. And the challenge here is you can't do a system like that in isolation. It touches payroll, it touches accounting, and there's a term in the industry for this enterprise resource planning software, ERP software, and you've heard of things like like PeopleSoft that are these all-in-one systems that you go buy it and it does everything. And I just checked while I was sitting in the audience, and if you Google ERP implementation catastrophic failure, you get 104,000 responses in about 0.4 seconds. Doing these projects all at one time as one big system is extraordinarily difficult across large enterprises. And so what this project is about is taking an element of that and trying to identify what's the best way to do the HR element while looking at what it's going to live within as it touches those financial systems and other systems so that we have a clear path to where we're going, but manage a scope of implementation that gets us not on that list of 104,000 hits for very difficult projects. Let's move on to the last one. Oh, no, next to the last one. This touches a little bit on the issue that Senator Johnson brought up at the outset, and it's a payroll consolidation project. And what we're looking at is this very question that the senator raised about why do we have all these back offices? And what we're trying to do is do some experimentation to look at our delivery of payroll services, which tend to be relatively small shops, even in fairly large agencies, and see if we can't consolidate those in some fashion to get some economies of scale. The project that I'm most involved in is a project between Department of Justice, Department of Revenue, and DCBS to work to consolidate our payroll shops into a single shop. Our model for that is really a co-location model. So we're each going to have our own people who are on our books as payroll people. We're going to continue to pay them as we pay them so we don't get into these rate issues that got raised earlier. But in looking at those three agencies, those are mainly people who work in an office environment with a normal 9-to-5 schedule, and so their payroll issues aren't complicated by huge amounts of overtime, waves of seasonal hiring, odd schedules, and those sorts of things. And so the nature of the payroll work is reasonably similar across the three agencies. We're right now working through a set of technology issues around how to share information across the agencies. We've identified some physical location to move those three sets of payroll teams to, and the idea is to create a single payroll shop, and then basically over time look at what do we get out of that? Are we able to, in fact, achieve efficiencies and spend less collectively on delivering that function? Are we able to be more effective? Are we able to reduce rework and errors and those sorts of things? And are we able to do that in a way that's replicable and can be shared either, you know, with larger clusters or across state enterprise? Other interesting piece about this project to me is that unlike something like enterprise email, where all I have to do is be a customer of something delivered by somebody else, this is three agencies that really have to sort of take off their agency hats for a little bit and think about how to function as an enterprise or as a cluster within the enterprise, and that really is a meaningfully different way to think about how you do your business. Let's go to the last one, which is my very favorite project of all of them, which is facilities leasing. The state of Oregon is the largest commercial tenant in the state, and we act like the local flower shop, with all due respect to anybody who has a flower shop, in terms of not taking advantage of the market power we have as a tenant. And so we do a whole bunch of things that sort of make sense in a narrow context of an individual agency or an individual function, but then roll up into some fairly bad results. So, for example, we tend to stay in places a fairly long time, and there's good reason for that, because if you're serving customers and the public, having the public know where DMV is, for instance, is useful, and you don't want to, you know, sort of be itinerant. Historically, we've kind of done that on the basis of short-term contracts with two-year renewals, because we have two-year budgets and two-year renewals with built-in escalator clauses, because it's easiest to not have to worry about having to do a full negotiation every 2 years. And what you end up with is this sort of a system that, if left on autopilot, gets you to some pretty weird places. And in the most recent downturn, where it got us was in places where we were very frequently paying well over market for leases for our facilities, and not taking advantage of very common tools in dealing with landlords. So what we set out to do in this project is the kind of the phrase we came up with was to create a credible threat to move. We wanted the landlord community to know that we weren't an automatic guaranteed customer, and that they actually needed to negotiate with us, and that we were going to negotiate fairly hard. We took about 50 of the largest leases that we had, and we actually contracted with a couple of commercial brokers to be our our representative and to go do that negotiating on our behalf with landlords. And the results, doing this 2 years ago when we were still coming out of the difficult economy, were really quite stunning. We were able to get standard terms that we were not typically getting around rent concessions, around tenant improvements, around certain numbers of months of rent paid. And we were able to really calibrate our leases back to market rates. We also started demonstrating a willingness to look at longer-term leases. And I think the numbers have changed now because the market has tightened. But we were in these large leases, typically going into 5 to 7 year leases, which is a much more common marketplace sort of a term, gets us access to much better rates. Let's go to the next slide. And the savings are really fairly dramatic over the length of time of the leases. That number on the left hand side is for our largest leases. The average term is about 4.7 years for those leases, and we've saved about $30 million over the life of those leases when compared to had we just simply behaved the way we used to behave in terms of those automatic renewals. Now an issue that we're looking at, and DAS is going to begin rulemaking on, is an issue of a built-in term that we do in leases around disappropriation. This is the provision of the lease that says if the legislature takes all our money away or makes the agency go away, we can get out of the lease scot-free. And there are a couple of really interesting problems that occur with that because the marketplace prices that in. To the marketplace, that looks like we can cancel the lease on our own for any reason at all. Operationally, we almost never get to use that function because you tend not to eliminate us as agencies, and if you make a budget reduction, we get into an argument with the landlord about, well, does this really affect your budget or not? And what we end up doing is what's a standard market term anyway, which is negotiating an early lease termination. So why not just do early lease terminations? And then what gets priced in is the fact that that termination clause makes the lease relatively unbankable to the landlord. It's difficult for them to use that as collateral in a loan because they've got this early out provision. And so we end up paying extra for a provision that we can't use. And so we're now working to actually change that and try to get our lease terms to a much more standard market-based term that translates into rates.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
I just want to go back to an exchange Mr. Jordan and I had on the first day, and that was to know what your total portfolio of space is. I think it's great that you're negotiating these, and there are example after example of some really dog buildings that you guys got into for agencies and you can't get out of. But if you don't know what your portfolio is, how can you be completely sure that you don't have unoccupied buildings? There was a big dust-up about an unoccupied building 5-6 years ago that nobody really remembered, and the lease payments were multiple thousand dollars a month. Mm. How do you reconcile something as innovative as this with the fact that you don't know what your portfolio is?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, knowing what our portfolio is part of the long-term project, and being able to make investments in systems that allow us to be able to manage that more aggressively. The DAS Real Estate Shop has come light years in the 2 years that I've been involved with this project in bringing private sector market. Well, lots of times we talk about government out operating more like a business, and a lot of times you kind of think that doesn't always work. This is a place where it really works, and DAS has made great strides to modernize its operations and make them look like modern property management functions, and that's a piece of the plan.
Let me just add one other thing. I won't mention the building, but it's one here in Salem that I worked in for a while that was a state leased building, and it was deemed a sick building early, and all sorts of maintenance improvements needed to happen, and there were no teeth in the lease to make that occur, as I was informed. I have no firsthand knowledge of it. But I certainly hope you're being aggressive with ongoing maintenance and remediation of environmental issues, and because we lose so many days with sick employees or people that think they've been made sick by a building. So I hope you're equally as aggressive with maintenance, ongoing maintenance, as you are with square footage and duration.
Yeah, Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I can't speak narrowly to that, but I would say that I think it's an example of one of the things where the market understanding that we're willing to pick up and move to another building has a
curative effect.
Beneficial effect was where I was going to go with that to deal with those issues.
And Madam Chair, if I may, before I know Senator Whitson has a question as well. Senator Johnson, back to your original question, we do know the buildings that we lease, what we aren't finished with is the condition analysis of the buildings we own. And we were able to actually made a mistake a couple of days ago when I said there wasn't an underlying report. Their staff were drafting one, and we have provided that to you. And I think Mr. Siebert has that in OLIS. So we do know the leases that we have that we can use to compare this to.
And then the last slide, I think, is just oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, I apologize, Senator Whitsitt.
No problem. Does DAS or any other agency actually audit the applicability or the appropriateness of the lease properties to the purpose for which they're being leased? And I was thinking along, I don't know if the CCB property was a DAS property. I don't know if the DSL property is a DAS property. But the CCB property had apparently at least a third or 40% more space than they needed. It had no parking, and it had extremely high utility costs and so forth. I believe the CCB went out and found a private thing that was a whole lot better. So it works both ways. The DSL building appears to me to be less than completely used. And so I'm wondering, is anybody auditing?
Do you know the answer to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, yes, our real estate agents work with agencies very closely at the time of when the earlier that we know that a lease is coming up for renewal, the more we are able to do several things. One is to work with them to clearly identify the business needs of the space that they have. The second then is to be able to find locations that meet that need better. And the third is then to be able to negotiate a better price. On this next slide, we'll give you an example of a couple of instances where the new leases were designed to meet specifically identified business needs for that agency.
Then the last slide is just to talk quickly about a couple of examples.
Yeah.
A couple of examples to kind of wrap this up. The first one is a state police consolidation and relocation. This is taking multiple facilities, many of which were in questionable condition, to Senator Johnson's point, and relocating them and shrinking that footprint. The savings to the state police was $8.1 million over the term of the combined terms of the lease. The second one is I talked about not wanting to relocate places like DMV, but we relocated a DMV, and this really was a.
This is going to bug me unless I know the answer to it. State police is constantly in need of money. So there was $8.1 million in savings. Who does that savings accrue to?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, that will accrue over the life of the lease to the state police.
How long a term are you spreading $8 million over?
I don't have that in
my we'll have to get back
pocket.
To you on that one.
Okay. Thank you.
And the other point, if I may, while we're on that topic, to Senator Whitsitt's question, another piece of this was consolidating the state police out of either in buildings that were in bad condition or weren't meeting their business needs, and they're all now closer to the freeway access, which is really important, obviously, for the state police.
The second one, I talked about not moving DMV, but this was one of those ones where we had a salutary effect on the market by moving DMV, because the landlord market out there notices when we take a fairly flagship kind of a function, and they're tempted to say, well, they're not gonna move that, and we move it, and that gets noticed in the marketplace, and we're able to leverage that in other transactions. In this case, we reduced the rent rate from $3.70 per square foot to $1 per square foot, which saved $14,000 a month, or $1.7 million over the 10-year term. We got some free rent in that. We got a moving allowance, project management allowance, tenant improvement allowances, which brought the total savings to DMV to $2 million over the length of that lease.
That's really great.
The employment department, the last one to talk about, that's a consolidation in Beaverton that consolidated a footprint they had from 52,000 square feet down to 37,000 square feet, and that really is an issue of the agency itself looking at how much space do we really need to occupy. This is a process that my own agency here in the Labor and Industries Building, not a rented facility, but the same principle, is going through to try to get ourselves to industry standards for occupying office space, to spend less money on air and cubicles and more on program. In their case, they were able to reduce the footprint, get 6 months of free rent, tenant improvements, moving allowances, architectural services, and save over the term of the lease just about $4.6 million. So this is a project, again, I'm very proud of, very pleased with the work that DAS has done to get us using basic good business sense practices and spreading them broadly across state government and being able to really be able to spend the resources that the people give us on the programs that we're charged with doing. With
and,
that.
Madam Chair, if I may, one last point that I'd like to make.
Yeah, before Mr. Allen goes, I want to say something too.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The other side to this coin is recognizing that the state is the largest lessor in the state. We also employ a lot of people in these local communities, and so the balancing act that we have to be constantly aware of in that exercising a credible threat of relocation is the impact that relocation can have on a community. And so it's really important, Representative Smith knows this well, in his area, when we close a state facility, the impact of that is not just to that landlord, it's to the local businesses in the area, the local grocery stores that are that the employees accessed and supported. So we do have to be very careful in this work to not only maximize the value we're getting out of the tax dollar and acting like a business in this case, but also recognizing the impact we have to both communities and downtowns and local main streets.
And that is a real issue. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate you raising that for the committee.
And I would.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I didn't know you were in here.
No,
I thought you stepped
fine.
On. I apologize.
No, I'm right here. Please, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Nathanson, I'll hold my comment for. No.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, on the topic of partnering with local governments, I really like to raise this issue every time I can, how we can, when we're able, partner with local communities. Every once in a while, we see that there might be an opportunity to share a facility. If a local area is having trouble building a new building or finding capacity to expand or relocate something, do you recall any stories in the last few years where we were able to both help a local community and do something we needed to do by partnering on a facility?
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, I'm not going to get all the details right or the specifics, but when we do this work, we are often closely engaged with the local governments, particularly local city councils, because particularly in the acquisition or disposition of properties, adding or subtracting from the local property tax rolls is important. And where we can create opportunities for co-location or for investment, we do look at that.
A brief follow-up.
Certainly.
Is there anything that gets in the way of doing that, statutory or business process, and anything that we can help with, or is it really just the type of thing that each situation has its own challenges and you can't anticipate?
I would just quickly say, Co-Chair Senator Representative Nathanson, my own experience as an agency head in this is not so much in helping projects get moving, but doing things like co-locating in, we have, for instance, building codes facilities that are in the city of Coos Bay. And the nature of those, really, they're one-off transactions that involve almost to the individual personalities of people involved in those transactions and trying to get them put together. They get much more complex as you actually start talking about development projects, and it really, I think, is difficult to broadly categorize them versus each one is a story, and the story's got elements that need to be managed independently.
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, I'm certain that our staff are listening, and if there are any of those barriers, I will get them as soon as I return to the office and get them to you.
Thank you very much.
The only comment I want to add at this point is I just want to highlight that Mr. Allen is the director of a big state agency all his own. And earlier this week we heard from Ms. Koba, from directors of other agencies, all of whom are electing to commit significant amounts of time to efforts to make our government more efficient, more cost effective, to make it run more like a business in the best sense of the term. And Mr. Allen did not take on this job necessarily knowing that he was going to be asked to do all of this. And I don't think there's any question about whether he's not only meeting his duties as head of DCBS, but also doing all of this stuff, as many other agency heads are doing as well. And you just happen to be sitting here at the end of this parade, Mr. Allen. So you're getting picked on, although I think positively. And I think it's a credit to our agency heads and to Mr. Jordan and his deputies, Ms. Miller and now Mr. Pack, for the systems that they're setting up and their ability to convince and then follow through agency heads and that they're going to be able to actually make differences and then follow through on that commitment. And as Representative Smith has alluded to on several occasions, I don't think it's just the minority's job to look for ways to make things more efficient and tweak things. I think it's all of our jobs. And in particular on this committee, when we're looking at the infrastructure agencies of the state, we have a significant obligation. And I think it's remarkable that we have agency heads of this caliber who are willing to take on these additional duties that are not specific to their jobs as agency directors, but are rather specific to the mission of this state to provide responsible usage of taxpayer dollars. And I want to thank you, Mr. Allen, and all of your colleagues who commit time to these projects. And I hope, Mr. Pack and Mr. Jordan, that you will convey my personal thanks to everybody who's willing to do that, because this is pretty cool stuff. I mean, $2 million over 10 years doesn't sound like a boatload of money, but $2 million here and $8 million there and $4.6 million there, and all of a sudden we're at 12.7, and if I'm doing my, no, 14.7, and then it keeps adding up and keeps adding up and keeps adding up, and all of a sudden we have some more teachers in our classrooms. So thank you. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I hope you remember your kind words, especially for Mr. Allen. We have stuck him with the short straw of taking on an enormous problem in his well.
I know, I was part of that committee.
I know you were, and that's why I'm just memorializing this. Having drawn the short straw and received Cover Oregon and having it embedded in his well-run little agency may curtail his ability to do these kind of broad global improvements. So I think the legislature needs to watch this very carefully and make sure that if DCBS looks like it's taking on water, that we give Mr. Allen the opportunity to come in and visit with us and explain why he doesn't have time to do this sort of stuff.
Completely agree, and I have complete faith in Mr. Pack and Mr. Jordan for cutting Mr. Allen the slack he needs to get that ship righted. So anyway, I won't ramble on further, but I don't think that this kind of work should go unnoticed, and I want to thank you and all of your agency head colleagues for taking on these jobs. So thank you, Mr. Allen,
and
thank you, Mr. Jordan and Mr. Pack, for creating an environment where these things happen. Okay, where are we? Is that the end of today, in theory? We actually got done with everything?
Mr. Allen talks faster than Mr. Jordan and I, so we're...
Or maybe we pester him less. okay, good. Colleagues, anything else we should know about? Mr. Representative Nathanson.
I would like to say today what I may have said once or twice already. I certainly hope to be able to say with future presentations how pleased I am at progress that's being reported. And I hope you share that with everybody who has helped making this possible and achieving these sorts of steps to make us either more efficient, provide better service to Oregonians, all the different objectives. I'm really pleased to see good news.
Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Nathanson, thank you for that. I would be remiss in not thanking my staff of project managers who do an awful lot of work on making these projects successful. But also, it's not just them. It's not just Director Allen. It's all of the staff in the agency divisions and work, that all of the payroll staff and the HR staff who are helping identify the business processes and helping us find solutions. Yeah. They also deserve a lot of credit. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's also the point. You're setting a tone where it's not top-down, where you are inviting the people who are on the front lines to engage in these conversations and figure out how to serve our customers better and make this place a better place to work, where you actually feel like you're getting something done. Anything else before we adjourn? Okay, we are adjourned.